Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We have a special guest in our studio today, so let's get right to it. Mayor Marty Walsh is here taking our questions and yours. Mayor Walsh, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be here.
And listeners, we would like to hear from you. What are your questions for the mayor? You can give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Mr. Mayor, I know you've been rolling out a legislative agenda for the upcoming year, and I want to get to that. But first, we got to talk about what's going on in Washington. The federal government is now in day 19 of a partial shutdown. President Trump was on live TV last night, reiterating his demand for a border wall. Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark told WBUR this morning that the president is using fear and division to get a wall. And Congressman Seth Moulton also spoke with us.
We got to understand why people are coming here in the first place and why so many of them are coming here illegally rather than legally. That's the problem that we need to fix. Give me a 25-foot wall and I'll show you a 30-foot ladder. The wall is not going to fix this problem.
So, Mr. Mayor, as you watch this stalemate unfold, how are you responding when there seems to be no end in sight?
Well, first of all, I think I have to say, when Seth Moulton speaks about why people are coming here in the first place, that's not often the conversation point. The conversation point is generally when you hear out of Washington, we have, 13 million undocumented people in the country. Let's get them out. I think there's a lot that has to be said there, which I'll come back to. I think what's happening now in this country with 19 days shut down over a wall is a disgrace. This isn't a fundamental issue between Democrats and Republicans in funding health care or education or transportation. We're talking about a wall. As the congressman said, you can put a 30-foot ladder on it, or you can build a tunnel, which is what one of the problems are. And I think that the fact that the American system, or most of our government, a lot of our government shut down, is going to have a bad reaction. People are concerned about it. There's no conversation about immigration reform. We talked off air about DACA. And an opportunity, is there an opportunity here with this conversation to talk about DACA? Is there an opportunity to talk about people with temporary protective status in this country from El Salvador and Haiti and other countries? And the fact that, this president has dug in and called a national press conference last night to talk about a wall is kind of ludicrous. And I think that looking at government and looking at where we're headed as a country, yeah, they're trying to divide it by fear, but I don't think it's working. I mean, not many people have said to me that the president's right in this, and I haven't heard on too many of the talk shows, if you will, at least some of them, or people outraged about not having a wall. But this is one of the fundamental issues in Washington, D.C. That's a problem, that people in America are sick and tired of this kind of type of gamesmanship, and for the same reasons why Donald Trump got elected president, he's playing the same game that he accused people of the swamp, and he's doing the same exact things, and I think it's awful.
But if the debate in Washington misses the mark, in your view, is that something you're emphasizing to the delegation? Like, are you taking Moulton or Clark aside and saying, could we get this moving here?
I haven't talked to any per se congressperson from Massachusetts directly about the government shutdown at this point yet. What I have said publicly and what I've said, they know how I feel. I think a lot of them feel on immigration. Is there an opportunity for immigration reform? Is there an opportunity to address some of the fundamental issues we have in this country with immigration that a lot of people talk about? Is there an opportunity to create pathways into the United States of America for people who want to come into this country and better their situation, maybe get out of countries? There is an asylum program that we have here in the United States. Is there an opportunity for us to, take some real bold action? And I think there is. I mean, most of the immigration reform packages that have been passed in this country over the last 50 years have been led by Democrats and Republicans. This has not been a partisan issue. It's been a bipartisan issue. If you talk to mayors around America, they have concerns about immigration. We have Democrats and Republican mayors in Anaheim, California. Mayor Tate, Republican, was worried 2 years ago how immigration and what Trump was going to do, how that would affect his employment opportunities in the city of Anaheim. and people taking jobs in the food service industry, in the hospitality industry. He's a Republican. He was worried about it. So this really is a fundamental issue that's on the street, and there has been no real conversation at a national level about moving beyond talking about building a wall or a fence or a gate or whatever it is that the president is proposing today. It's more than that. And I don't know if he's capable, he being the president, to understand the importance of making a deal here and understanding that there's a give and take. So if there was an opportunity to present some solutions to DACA and TPS and some of the other pathways to citizenship, I don't know if he's capable of being able to negotiate that. I don't know if he keeps going back to the people that elected him in his base. I'm not sure if people are willing to be able to resolve that issue right now. All I know is that here in Boston, we're seeing the effects of the shutdown. I was approached today by a news outlet in Boston that showed me the trash around the Bunker Hill Memorial Monument. It's a federal property. So we're going to send public work crews out to clean it up today and start to do some of that work. But that doesn't resolve it. There's still 800,000 Americans that haven't received a check in 2 weeks, soon to be 3 weeks, that work for the federal government that aren't doing an important job. Behind-the-scenes jobs are important about moving our country forward.
Well, so it's those workers, but it's also the contractors as well. And we know that Boston is a hub for both. It's a hub for federal workers and people who have contracts to work for the federal government. Yeah. And we spoke just yesterday with Jim Cassetta. He's the CEO of Work Incorporated, yeah, which is a nonprofit that connects people with disabilities to jobs in the Boston area. And he told us about one group of workers who were on contract with the Department of Environmental Protection in Post Office Square.
Out of the 15, 10 people have significant disabilities. They're not on public assistance. They live on this paycheck and this paycheck alone. And I don't know exactly what each of their living situations are, but I do know this. These folks have minimal savings and live paycheck to paycheck.
So there's a real life anecdotal, yeah, reminder that it's not just a Washington issue, and there's a real personal toll here.
And I know Jim, and I know Work Incorporated, and they do incredible work. And these the people that work with Work Incorporated do have severe disabilities, and they're incredible human beings, incredible people, and members of our society. And you know, a lot of those young people, the people that work there, they go through a program, they get job training, and they do incredible work. And Jim Cassette has many contracts, but I wasn't aware they had a federal contract. And again, you know, the 10 people that he talked about today, or 15 people, but 10 not working, they live a life with a routine. Their routine is to get up, get ready, go to work. They go to Work Incorporated. They socialize, and it's a way of life. And it's kind of we in the Commonwealth over the years have moved people from group living with disabilities into individual and getting people back in their home. And Jim's focus is making sure that people can live a sustainable life on their own with support services. And to lose this does an awful lot of damage to individuals. And I wasn't aware that Jim had a contract with the federal government. I should have known that. And there's probably one of several he has. And they're not alone. There's other other organizations here in Boston, in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, that have these. So again, when I break it down, you know, every night I go home and I, you know, I'll read the news of the day and I'll watch, you know, MSNBC, CNN, and other stations. And unfortunately, nothing is surprising me now coming out of Washington. But the fact that we're 19 days and it's almost like a game to the White House. It's not even it doesn't seem like there's no seriousness to it. It's almost like a game to him. And, you know, his first press conference was with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, and how he'd say, we're going to work together and I'm not going to blame anybody. If I shut the government down, it's me. And then he flips it and turns it's the Democrats shutting the government down. No, it's not. No, it's not. If you talk to, if you get a chance to go down and talk to Republicans in Washington, they feel the same way. They understand the pettiness of what the president is doing on a border wall.
Right. Well, some of the Republicans are worried that he might give away too much in exchange because, yeah, he's so fixated on the wall. And this whole border wall debate is really about immigration at its core. And you've fought for Boston's status as a sanctuary city. At one point, you even said you'd shelter people in City Hall, yeah, itself as a last resort if need be. Yet it appears that for some undocumented children, even their public schools are not shielded from federal immigration officials. I'm thinking of how WBUR recently has been reporting on how information flows from Boston School Police to the Boston Regional Intelligence Center, or the brick, and then sometimes on to immigration and customs enforcement. Our own Shannon Dooling recently followed an East Boston high school student to El Salvador, where he had been deported after a cafeteria fight. So I guess my question is, if Boston is a sanctuary city, why is that information flowing from our schools to ICE?
I can't really talk too much about that because there's an open litigation case right now. But you know, we made it very clear in the very beginning when prior to the president being president and even now, because even under the Obama administration, there's some concerns about information flowing to ICE and undocumented immigrants, information flowing. The students in our schools are safe. We're making sure they are safe. If there are kids involved in illegal activity, young people involved in illegal activity, that's something that will have to be handled in a different manner. We can't let people who – and I'm not saying that that's the case in what you talked about earlier, and I don't know the situation with the young man in El Salvador, but we are going to make sure that the kids in our schools are safe and making sure that the young people in our schools are safe. We're working with organizations like ROCA to work with kids that might be intertwined with gangs like MS-13 and 18th Street to make sure that they understand that there's another way of life for them, and we're working to create opportunities. I met ROCA the other day in the office, and we talked about this and building a collaboration a little more in the city of Boston, particularly for undocumented kids and kids from Central America. So it's constant. I try to focus on how do we keep kids from joining these so-called gangs, and how do we make sure that they feel safe in this country? Some of them flee their homeland to get away from these same exact people that are here in Boston and in America. So we have work to do on that side of it. But if somebody does commit a serious crime, or if somebody is in the potential of committing a serious crime, we have to look and make sure that people are safe.
Well, just to fill in a little bit more detail on that case of this East Boston student I mentioned, a school police officer had identified him as an associate of the MS-13 gang. Of course, that's the one that's attracted so much public attention for its brutality, and nobody wants actual
brutality on other Central American kids. Very bad brutality.
Often, yeah. And nobody wants them running around our schools, obviously, but the student says he was never in the gang. And we also have heard from former Boston Police Gang Detective Tom Nolan, who says the assessments of school police can be dubious.
Boston school police are putting in information into the BRIC database that's oftentimes not only inaccurate, but they're exceeding the bounds of their authority.
So as you said, obviously we want to keep our students safe. But how do we make sure?
I've never met Tom Nolan. He hasn't been in the BRIC in a long, long time, and he wasn't there into my administration and Commissioner Evans' administration. So I think that he might want to have a conversation with Commissioner Gross just to get updated on exactly what the process is today. I know it's been several years since he's been in a Boston police officer.
But are you convinced that the information going into the BRIC, especially from the school system, is accurate though?
I would hope that all. I can't say I'm convinced on every single bit, but I would want to say I'd hope that all the information that goes in there is accurate. And I also would hope that if we identify a young person that could be caught up in some type of gang activity or gang life, that there's an opportunity for us to try and work with the young person and get them into a safer space. Because a lot of times what I've heard with MS-13 and 18th Street is there's a pressure for young people to join. If they don't join, their life is at stake. And I think there's an opportunity for us, if there's young people listening today or families listening today, that if you are concerned about your young person, reach out to us. Reach out to the school administration. Reach out to the principals in the schools. So we can try and intervene in a positive manner. Our goal is not to lock people up. It's to lift people up. And that means for people that are undocumented and undocumented, I'd rather have a safer school environment where we can teach a young person something they might be thinking of doing in a bad manner and get them on the right track.
All right, let's stick with education because just this morning you were at a news conference announcing your support for a state bill called the Education Promise Act. It would increase public school funding by millions of dollars. Here's State Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz, who filed the bill, speaking at that news conference this morning.
Every year that we fail to get this done, we are accepting another class of economically disadvantaged children graduating through our system without access to arts programming or computer science or foreign language classes or a soccer team or a school psychologist. My friends, there are no more excuses. It is time to keep our promise.
And just a reminder, listeners, we want to hear from you. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. So, Mr. Mayor, why are you supporting this education bill that we just heard about from Sonia Chang?
If we don't modernize our funding in Boston in the next 2 years, Boston will be receiving zero state aid for our 55,000 students, and we'll be paying money to the district for reimbursement.
This is based on the 26-year-old formula.
The formula also was created in 1993. 25 years of research and education in education, changing the way that we deliver services and the way we deliver education. Something has to be updated. The system does not work for – it's not just Boston. This is a many cities and towns across Massachusetts. Ultimately, this bill lifts all cities and towns for education funding. It's something that is desperately needed. It's a bill that combines the Foundation Review Budget Commission recommendations that create guarantee minimum levels for districts funding in all different districts. Today, when we sat there, we had state reps and state senators from all over the Commonwealth. We had mayors from Lawrence and from North Attleboro, from Medford, in Medford, and some other folks, East Longmeadow, I believe, that were there talking about creating opportunities. 2 minutes ago, we just talked about a young man potentially involved in gang activity. The way we keep young people out of gang activity is by fully funding and creating good opportunities for education. The way we deal with income inequality is by we making sure young people have the opportunity for a good, strong start through education. If we want to deal with the issues of racism, it's about creating opportunities, good, strong start for young people to get opportunities to battle back racism. In this funding bill, it would allow Boston the opportunity to implement the universal pre-kindergarten program for four-year-olders in our high quality in our city. Studies show that if a four-year-older gets a strong start in school, if they get a strong start at 4 years old, there's a better chance of graduation from high school and colleges, opportunities there. This also looks at some of the things that Senator Sonia Chang has talked about, English language learners, special ed. Allows the opportunity for special ed, increase in special ed, and fully funding schools in such as sports programs and art programs. We've invested in Boston since 2014, $250 million in education, but we're still paying for shortfalls from the state, and something has to be done here. This is something that's drastic. It's about the future of our young people. And working off a formula that's 26 years old just doesn't work anymore. It's about how do we create new opportunities and making sure that if we're going to do a bill, don't have suburban versus urban districts, making sure that it's across the board for all of our young people.
All right, let's bring you, our listeners, into the conversation. Charles in Roslindale has an education-related question for the mayor. Charles, welcome to Radio Boston. What's your question for Mr. Mayor?
Hi, thanks. I was really happy to hear Mayor Walsh speak on the importance of the funding education this morning, and it's really critical to update the state's education formula for many communities around the state. But Boston is an increasingly rich city, and it has a high-need school system, and I'd really like to hear what local funding increases the mayor is planning to seek for BPS students, and particularly whether he plans on pursuing revenue from full pilot payments by wealthy tax-exempt universities and other nonprofits in the city.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for the call. Let me just take a step back. Again, these are typically the – not you, sir, who called in, but these are typically the arguments we go right back to. Cities, Boston's a wealthy city. Just to be clear, if we don't have a change in the formula in 2 years, Boston will receive $0 from the state, which means that any money that we have in our coffers that are going towards other services will have to go to fully fund education. And there's an opportunity there, but that's the argument that I'll hear from certain people, maybe at the state, that might say that you have the money, you don't need this money. You absolutely do need this money. And we do have the largest district. We have the largest district with the biggest amount of challenges. We have the biggest amount of ELL students, the biggest amount of special ed students, special needs students. We have buildings that were built in two-thirds of our buildings were built before World War II in the city of Boston. Our kids are learning in a 19th, 20th century building. We're making investments in those areas. We are looking, and we've made over 5 years, $250 million of investments, meaning the bottom line of our school department has gone up over $250 million since I've taken office. And we're going to make another, we're in the budget process now, so we're going to make another investment. We're making these large investments in the schools and in the school department, making sure we get money to the classrooms for education. But if we don't change something at the state level, we will have to make decisions somewhere down the road on whether or not we're funding public works, transportation, or if we fund education. On the pilot program piece, we are receiving money from the college universities, and we're looking at and having conversation with them now is that they pay more money. But the issue then there is also they pass that cost back down to the student. And I think some of our hospitals and some of our churches and our nonprofits are all tax exempt in the city of Boston. And, you know, we're trying to find that magic formula. It's in the last 20 years, it's been reworked 3 or 4 or 5 different times. And we're trying to figure out as we move forward, how do we increase more money into pilot? By saying that, just so listeners are clear, universities also partner with us in other ways. It's not just simply pilot programs. We have scholarship programs that we run through these different universities. We have teacher training opportunities. We have summer camps. We have a lot of other opportunities that we work with these colleges, universities on, in the hospitals, quite honestly, to make sure that they're enhancing young people's education here in the city of Boston. So it's not just a simple pilot program. It's a whole partnership that we have with a lot of these college universities.
And they churn out our future taxpayers as well. Don't forget that either.
They do.
Let's get to another one of your big fiscal issues. You unveiled a bundle of 14 bills that you plan to send to the state legislature. But one of the focal points is housing. Could you give us the highlights? What are you hoping to accomplish?
Yeah, a couple of things in the housing piece is that we want to do preserving inclusionary development housing. Right now, if you can build an as-of-right home for 10 units, you have no zoning requirements. And in those 10 units, we get zero IDP, inclusionary development money, or a unit for affordable housing. We want to go to the State House and ask for a change in that. We want to be able to get a change in some of these as-of-right projects, 20, 30 units of housing. As-of-right, they don't allow us any dollars of inclusionary development money, which could go into affordable housing, or there's no set-aside for any type of low-income housing on those projects.
And you could really use that money, right? Because this ambitious goal you've laid out.
Either the money or the units.
I see.
Yeah,
right.
We could use the units too. The units go towards the goal, and the units allow opportunities. And many of these developments that are being built are built in the in the neighborhoods, and creating opportunities in neighborhoods for people to stay is something that's important. We're working on ensuring the right to counsel in eviction proceedings, making sure that people have court-appointed lawyers in evictions, so that people have some representation there, making sure that people just aren't being evicted. Somebody comes in, buys a building, all of a sudden just wants to unload the building, and having right of counsel having in that eviction process. We're also working preventing protections for elderly tenants in housing, people that are over 75 years old. What's happening, people come in, buy a home, raise the rents too high, tenant has to move out. We're putting a cap on those elderly tenants for about, I think it's 5%. We're going to start with 5%. We'll see that either go up or go down to make sure that you can't price out a tenant out of a community. And that's something we're seeing a lot of lately. I think we have, our elderly commission has about 900 open cases of senior citizens that live in the city of Boston that are having a difficult time because their rents are being raised. We're also we're filing a bill to leverage commercial development and build housing that creates jobs, and making sure that we look at some of the money that comes out of these different projects that are important.
Robert in Fall River has a housing related question for the mayor. Robert, welcome to Radio Boston. What's your question?
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Business Insider has Boston listed as the third most expensive city to rent an apartment in, 2-bedroom, and 7th in the world. And I'm wondering what your reaction is to that. And it sounds like your comments earlier border around rent control.
No, I wouldn't say that. One of the things when I got elected in 2014 that we realized really quickly is that we have a major housing shortage, a housing crisis in the city of Boston. We were seeing that many of the units of housing were being sold and people were paying very high amounts for their houses. And we weren't creating enough housing stock to be able to fulfill and create opportunities for people to stay in the city of Boston. So we got to work. We came up with a housing plan to create 53,000 units of new housing by the year 2030. In that plan, we have about 26,000 units in the permitting pipeline. We have about another 26,000 either built or under construction right now in the city of Boston. And we realized that our plan is we're going to far surpass our plan of 53,000 units of new housing. At the end of last year, we have built more low-income housing in the city of Boston in a 5-year period than any other period in the history of our city. So we raised that housing goal to 69,000 units of housing. Our goal was 700,000 people by the year 2030, 53,000 units of housing. Now our goal is 756,000 people by the year 2030. with 69,000 units of housing. We really have to continue to create more opportunities for housing. I've collaborated with the metro mayors from the greater Boston area. We launched a plan in the fall of last year to create 185,000 units of new housing in the greater Boston area. 69,000 of those units are Boston's. Working with the state and working with all the different partners we have to create more opportunity and more housing stock on the market, and particularly moderate low-income housing. I mean, low-income housing is key. Moderate income housing is key as well to keep people here. But we have to, if we want to be a city that's a city for everyone, we have to continue to create more housing opportunities. And also we have to rely and hopefully get some support from our neighbors in cities adjoining, connected to us. I know Quincy's built a large amount of housing. Braintree's built a large amount of housing. Cambridge, Somerville, Chelsea. There's housing being built in all those areas, but the demand is just so high.
But you know the complaints from landlords, right? I mean, in your example, you're protecting grandma who's over 75 from paying too much of the rent increase, but you may have a landlord who says, I can't get market value for the investment that I've made. And somewhat related to that is some of the city's new rules around short-term rentals, right? You know, you've heard the complaints from people who want to list their homes or maybe investment properties on Airbnb. As of this year, they can't do that.
Short-term rentals are taking rental units off the market. And what we were seeing is that we were approving developments in the city of Boston to be built that were going to be housing and leased housing or rented housing, if you will. And we were seeing those being flipped over to Airbnbs. And that wasn't the intention of them, the approval in the very beginning. And that wasn't what the community process was. As far as people getting market rate, people are getting market rate today. And I think that that's the positive side, I guess, of a good economy is people are selling their homes for money that, you know, I'll give you an example. My parents bought our house on Taft Street in 1967 for, I think, $17,500. A house went for sale on Taft Street a few months ago for $1.2 million, a three-family, and there's a house listed, I think, now for $1.6 million on Taft Street. Wow. It's all three families, no driveways. Our side of the street has a yard about 12 by 12. The other side of the street has a little bit bigger of a yard. There's literally no driveways. We have no trees. It's just a street of three deckers. And it's just that when you think about it, and people are selling, but a lot of people don't have a place to go when they're selling. So my concern is making sure we can keep the seniors and people in their homes. And we're creating programs in the city of Boston, home update programs where seniors can get free boilers. We've worked on giving discounts on water and sewer rates. We've worked with cable companies on this. So we're trying to keep people in their home the best we can as we move forward.
Your parents are sitting on a gold mine, Mr.
Yeah. But where are they going to go? Where are my mother going to go? My father's not with us anymore.
On the short terms, you know, Airbnb is suing the city because it's not happy, of course, with some
They don't have to report.
Well, so are you going to enforce, in particular, the ban on the investment properties going up on Airbnb? Will you enforce that even as the litigation goes on?
Well, we're gonna force it while it's going on. Right now, we're creating the registry. I mean, we're talking about people that are most of these are investor units. We protected the folks that live in their home and they want an Airbnb an apartment. We're protecting them, but these are really the investor units. We're really focused on people that own multiple properties that are using them simply as revenue generating, and they have a right to. But again, it's taking these housing units off the market, and it's changing the character of a neighborhood in a lot of ways. And I think we've heard a lot of complaints about that. And we were very careful, the council, city council and myself, to make sure that as we move forward, people who live in their home that have an opportunity to Airbnb their house, they can if they want, if they live there. And that's there's no restriction there. If they own a second property, I believe we give them an opportunity to rent one of their units for a certain amount of time. But again, this industry, it came in here unregulated and had no regulation, was paying no taxation, and was just overrunning certain neighborhoods in the city of Boston, where people then were deciding to sell their homes and sell their properties and because it was an investor unit.
If you see violations, will you come down on Airbnb or on the homeowner? Because Airbnb says it's not us. We're just the platform.
Yeah,
it's the homeowner.
I believe it's the homeowner that's going to get. But Airbnb has some restriction, has some regulation they have to apply. They have to give us some information.
All right.
Let me just stick with Airbnb. If Airbnb came in the very beginning, we asked them for information. They said no. So this was a conversation we tried to have in the very beginning to understand the importance of having a conversation with them about how do we come up with a system that's fair and equitable for everybody.
All right. I'm going to have David in Jamaica play and help us shift gears a little bit to transportation. David, what's your question for the mayor?
Well, my mayor, thanks for taking my call. It's kind of a transportation question. It's really a way of life question. So I live in JP. I've been living in Boston for 40 years. My girlfriend's a lifelong New York City girl, and we have a Boston-New York rivalry. I know you kind of like that. And, you know, we started with sports, and, well, that was over in no time. We won that one hands down. But then she challenged me to a way-of-life competition, and I said, you know, wait. In Boston, we've got this 311 number. It's fabulous. You call. You get your matter handled right away. And she said, yeah, but she said, look at street cleaning. She said she gets street cleaning twice a week, 52 weeks out of the year. Joey has to move her car in a 90-minute window, and she can do her email and everything else. And she said, look at you. You get street cleaning twice a month, 7 months out of the year, and you got to move your car for 4 hours. Who can do that? You know, so she said, okay, I gave her that one. And she said, in New York, there's a trash can or two or four in every intersection. And in Boston, you need an app to find one. Okay,
she's not writing all that stuff. I would challenge her to tell her. I think we have a cleaner city than almost any city in America, by the way. And I had the U.S. Conference of Mayors here in June, and every single mayor, including Mayor de Blasio from New York, who's from Cambridge originally, couldn't get over how clean the city of Boston was. And I think that, you know, we have a very clean city. We have our public works department works really hard. We've increased the number of folks they're called Hokies that go out. I think when I started, we had 30 Hokies. We have 90 now that are out there cleaning our streets. And I also think that the responsibility for cleaning streets and gutters isn't just the city. It's people who live in the city who need to go out every now and then in front of their home, in front of their business, and take a shovel and a broom and a barrel and clean up in front of their homes. I do it in front of my house still. I was doing it the other day. And I think the responsibility can't be – you can't leave it just on the city. And I would say I think we're a cleaner city than New York. And no offense to New York. It's a nice city. But I think we're – not only are we better sports fans and better sports teams, I think we're cleaner.
Somewhat related quality of life question. David was talking about having to move his cars around here. Dylan's calling in from Brighton. He's got a question that sort of relates to that. Go ahead, Dylan.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, so I work out of the Back Bay. And within the last year or two, the parking meters in the Back Bay have gone up significantly. It's for two hours, it costs $7 to park in the Back Bay.
Yeah, and certain ones, yeah.
No, not certain ones, all over. All over the Back Bay, all over from Arlington.
The mayor's shaking his head, Dylan.
Yeah, not,
the mayor's wrong.
Okay,
mayor's
I'm wrong. I don't think
all
I'm wrong, but it's all right.
Man, I work back there.
I'm not, okay.
All throughout the spring. And it's getting a parking ticket is a better option than paying the parking meters if you're going to be parked there all day. So if I'm wrong, I'll take that. Where am I wrong? Where should I park where it's not $7?
No, there are certain areas around, I want to say around Boylston and Newberry, that we put in the pricing there, the change in pricing there. One of the things that we did it for was to see if we could cut down on congestion in those neighborhoods, free up parking spaces for the businesses in those neighborhoods. And to some degree, it's worked in some parts and it hasn't worked in other parts. People were parking, taking the ticket, and not parking in garages all day. And the parking meters really technically aren't meant to be parked in all day long. They're meant to be parking for a couple hours parking to allow people the opportunity to move around. And we saw a little bit of relief, particularly on Newberry Street, of people driving around looking for a spot and actually were able to get more open spots. That's the reason why we did it. It wasn't about the increase in revenue. If you don't mind, Dylan, if they could grab in the studio, take your number down. I'd love to have somebody call you and talk a little bit about it, some ideas you might have. I'll have somebody from transportation,
yeah, sure.
Chris Osgood, call you because I'd love to hear from people that work back in the Back Bay just to hear about concerns you have and challenges you have and maybe some ideas you might have that could be helpful.
Well, you know, it hurts, you know, if somebody's making $13 an hour. I mean, if you park for 8 hours in the Back Bay, it's going to cost you $54 to park there if you're working. And people that have to drive that need a car to come in, that they can't rely on public transportation, that's going to be almost half what they make for the day. And, you know, you're talking about making it easier for businesses and whatnot. What about people that work in those businesses?
Yeah, so do me a favor, please, don't hang up. Let somebody in the studio here get your phone number, and I guarantee somebody will call you in the next day or so.
Thanks for the call, Dylan.
And again, you know, I hear what Dylan's saying because I tend to go on the side of the worker. But one of the concerns we have, people, even some of the businesses, not just the Back Bay, but other parts of the city, they want to keep the spots open for customers. And it's one of those things, it's a catch-22.
So listen, parking meters is about as local as it gets, but you sounded awfully natural talking Washington at the top here, Mr. Mayor. So
it was easier talking Washington.
All right. Well, so as we close out here, the obvious follow-up is, do you have any desire to maybe go down there and, you know, fix things yourself?
Maybe I'll go down and talk to them. No desire.
You know what I mean, in the form of an elected office.
Listen, I love being the mayor of Boston, and I love the challenges that we have here. The one thing I think is really important for every listener to listen to is, you know, we might disagree on parking meters and on fees and on different things we do here in Boston, but we have a great city, and we're moving forward, and there's a lot of great talking points and selling points to our city. We don't have the same type of rhetoric that's going on in Washington where they can't agree on what day it is, never mind what to fund. There's lack of a housing policy, lack of a transportation policy, lack of an education policy, lack of an environmental policy, and we're working on them all here in Boston. And I think that to all the people listening from Boston and from Massachusetts, we should be happy we live here. We might not agree on every single issue that comes up, but at least we're civil to one another, and we all care about the same thing as far as moving our city and our state forward.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, thanks so much
your
time. And thank you, listeners, for your contributions during that segment as well. Please stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.